Topic of our Dhamma talk tonight is attitudes do matter in the practice of mindfulness meditation. Now, though we may be following meticulously the schedule and doing each and every sitting meditation and each and every walking session, even though we may be observing the 8 precepts as best as we can, and even though we may be restraining our senses, not looking here and there, not paying too much attention to external sounds and satna the like, observing silence, and even though we are following meticulously and following and applying the instructions as given in the Satipatthana Sutta, as well as given by the teachers here, yet our meditation practice may what? Unfold or not? It might not unfold properly. Now, the reason for it this might be that our attitude towards practice is not helpful. Instead of using the word attitude, we might sadhana also use the term approach. Our mental approach towards sadhana, the practice, the mental inclination that we bring towards the practice. So, over the years, I have found that attitudes with which meditators practice do matter a great deal. And on one occasion, a Burmese Satna Sayadaw, who is Satna now, who founded his own monastery here in this very country in California, who came back to Burma for a visit and then interviewed the foreign meditators. He did comment on how important it was to pay attention to the attitudes with which a retreatant practices. And these attitudes do, to some extent, become obvious during the interviews. Now, to simplify matters, we could distinguish between unhelpful attitudes and helpful attitudes towards practice. Now, what we shall do is first look at some attitudes that are not really helpful to practice. Having done this, we will then go on to elaborate or to discuss other attitudes that tend to be more conducive to practice. And that will lead to a proper unfolding of the practice. Now, the first case, and for you to figure out which mental state lies behind it. A retreatant during the very first few days of a retreat, during a sitting, has a beautiful experience. The mind is so calm, the body is so still and calm, and it's so easy to observe the rise and fall. There is a sense of peacefulness that goes with the experience. One is taken away by this wonderful session. Now comes the next sitting, at the beginning of which one closes the eyes, starts observing the rising and falling movement of the abdomen, and then a thought crosses the mind. Oh, it would be so nice if I could get that calmness from the previous sitting back. What is this? What kind of attitude speaks from this kind of a thought? Greed. There you go. Greed to repeat or to recreate a certain wonderful experience. Now, greed or desire might also manifest as having high expectations with regard to what should be happening in one's meditation, having anticipating certain experiences, having heard from others, oh, I had this or that experience, and then wanting to have a similar experience. Wishes, desires for certain experiences to take place, these are all expressions or manifestations of an greed-oriented attitude, or you could put it as a goal-oriented attitude towards practice. Now, at other times, it certainly could be that we are sitting in meditation and are experiencing a number of difficult bodily as well as mental formations. For instance, a number of bodily pains come up. And then we find ourselves avoiding those certain pains, or even trying to get rid of them, as well as the accompanying mental formations. Or we might find, even though a teacher is trying to give good advice, to give a helping hand, yet the retreatant is resisting. Resisting the help offered, help or advice offered by a teacher, resisting the meditation method in itself, resisting the place or the location of the retreat center, and resisting difficult experiences altogether. Which mental attitude stands behind this? Or which mental factor colors this attitude? Aversion. It's easy to see. So the next time around, when you find yourself being a bit aversive to a certain experience, then not only look at the difficult physical or mental experience or formation, but also on occasion take a closer look at the aversive mental attitude with which you are handling what is happening in your practice. Now, sometimes, not all the time, sometimes, a retreatant might come for an interview and then might be given good advice, and our retreatant thinks, well, this I know already. It's nothing new. And for this I don't have to come for an interview. Or, in a Dhamma talk, some important point is being made, and the retreatant silently sits there and thinks, my goodness, this is below standard. I don't need to hear this kind of teachings. I know this already. Or one might, to overdo it a little bit, one might certainly feel, well, I know this already. I seem to be knowing everything much better than the teacher or my fellow retreatants. Now, which mental factor determines this attitude or colors this attitude? What would you say? delusion for one thing. You know, that's generally stated yet incorrect. More specifically,
conceit.
There you go. Pride and conceit. And pride and conceit usually manifests as feeling. Feeling or thinking of oneself equal to others, superior to others, or at times even inferior to others. So pride and conceit oftentimes is involved when the mind starts comparing oneself to others. So if you find your mind is doing this, then be careful and pay close attention to what is happening. Now, pride and conceit might also come into play when one has just accomplished to sit for 2 hours non-stop and no one else remains in the meditation hall. Everyone else has left beforehand and one feels so great. Am I not a great retreatant for having sat for 2 hours non-stop? Nobody can compete with me. This too is an expression of an attitude that is governed by pride and conceit. Now, if you keep comparing your own practice to others' practice, will this help your meditation? Will it accelerate your practice? Probably not. Now, on occasion, we might find within ourselves or also in others a different kind of attitude. This time, the emphasis seems to be on my practice. So, always talking about my practice, my way of practice. The teacher says one thing, but I don't want to do it that way. I will do it my way. Or my seat in the meditation hall. Someone has been daring enough to take my seat. Or taking a pretty ego-centered attitude. And this then, it may manifest as trying to manipulate one's experiences, trying to interfere in what is happening, or to just use its different word, trying to control what is happening. Now, this too is an attitude that is not necessarily helpful. And what would you think? Which mental factor is at work? Which mental factor determines this attitude? This one is a bit more difficult. Delusion, of course. Yes, that's underlying.
Selfing.
Yeah. Okay, now that's correct. And what's the mental factor? You're saying the right thing. Attachment to
self-view.
There we go. So, wrong view. The wrongful belief in the existence of a self, or simply just a wrong understanding of interpreting things in a wrong way. Now, clearly, meditation practice is not about me, me, me all the time, but rather about letting go of that ego-centeredness. The more we practice, the more this sadhana eventually happens. Now, at times, one might especially in the case of a beginning retreatant, being totally new to mindfulness, certain meditation, one might not understand what is really meant by the practice, how to do it, and satna thus take a somewhat confused attitude towards the practice. Confused, a bit ignorant attitude. Thinking, just as an example, that mindfulness meditation, satipatthana meditation, is primarily, and its ultimate goal is to feel great, to feel happy all the time. Now, is this really the case? Is this the ultimate certain goal of satipatthana practice? It's not. So there are, I've been told, retreatants certain to whom this goal of achieving a state of well-being, so to be freed from one's bodily distress and mental distress, is the most important thing. So just this feel, to achieve a state of a good, pleasant feeling. Now, the mental factor that speaks out of this, or that underlies this particular attitude, is clearly one of delusion. Delusion, ignorance. It's certainly a very simple case. Now, at other times, a retreatant with the best intention does the practice, but is somewhat unconvinced, doubtful about the teachings, about the teacher, about the practice, about one's own ability to do the practice, having little esteem for the practice, the practice of mindfulness, and being overly skeptical. Practicing with this kind of an attitude will be very helpful or not. In modern sciences, we have to be skeptical. We have to doubt various statements being made. And in Vipassana practice, if you're overly skeptical, it will not help your practice. So, the mental factor that underlies certainly this particular attitude obviously is a skeptical doubt. It is, as the Buddha has stated in the text, good to be doubtful of dubitable things, but it is useless to be doubtful of things such as Satna, the teachings of Satna, the Buddha himself, and Satna, so on. If certain things, certain aspects one doesn't understand as yet, then one might at least consider to set these satna points aside and satna then to simply go on with one's satna practice, and satna then sooner or later there's a good chance that the answer will come up. Now, when you find yourself in San Francisco's Japanese garden, playing frisbee, throwing frisbees with your friend, then you will be doing this most likely with an easygoing attitude. So it's your leisure time, and there's probably no major pressure on you, and you're just doing it for the fun of it. Now, this might be the correct attitude, or might be a possible attitude when being in San Francisco's Satna Japanese garden and enjoying oneself. But If we bring that same kind of attitude to our mindfulness practice, then you would agree that this is useful or not? Probably not. So, mindfulness practice is not to be done with a sloppy, easygoing, casual, negligent or neglectful attitude towards practice. Taking on an attitude of carelessness, of heedlessness, of being lax and inattentive, slack, forgetful, unmindful, unconcerned. So mindfulness practice is everything but these points that have been mentioned. Now, at times we might certainly find ourselves in a retreat and we've worked quite hard for a while, maybe for a day or two, and certainly the practice is unfolding quite nicely, and then the thought crosses the mind. Now I've really earned myself some leisure time. And basically becomes somewhat sluggish, unprepared to observe whatever predominant object comes up. One allows the mind to become inactive. Which mental factor lies behind this? Behind this particular attitude towards practice?
Torpor.
Sloth and torpor. That's it. And so, basically, what is happening? One allows the mental factor, the unwholesome mental factor of sloth and torpor to influence one's attitude. And certainly that, for sure, will not really help one's own practice. Now, one might certainly think, okay, so taking on a lethargic and inactive, a bit lazy, sluggish attitude towards practice is not recommended. Well, then I'll do the opposite. And what about this? Well, then practices with the greatest zeal possible. Day and night, sleep is not necessary anymore, meals is for the others, not for me. Would this attitude work? It will not work either. Now, in this case, what is happening? Which mental factor is at work? Viriya. And too little of it? Too much of it. Excessive effort. So it is excessive effort then that determines our attitude, and this might then have unexpected, unpleasant results. Now, at times, there's a number of other attitudes that unhelpful attitudes that could be mentioned, but I'll briefly mention just one more. Most of us would consider the arising of joy as a phenomenon that we would welcome. And we would certainly encourage this even. And certainly so when we practice with an overly joyous attitude, we might certainly think that certainly this will then bring about certain changes, wholesome changes in our practice. There is a certain point in our meditation practice when this particular attitude of excessive joy will not be too helpful. And it will basically bring about a certain agitation in the mind, and with an agitated mind, it's going to be difficult to observe predominant objects. Now, let us certainly take a look at some other ways towards or approaches, attitudes towards sattva practice. Now, on many occasions, the Buddha has recommended various reflections. Reflections on the Dhamma, reflections on one's meditation practice. And in the context of attitudes towards our own mindfulness, sattva meditation, it might be worth to reflect on the search, that the spiritual search that we are engaged in. Now, the spiritual search that for which we are here is not to be underestimated. For the most part, it is certainly rooted in wholesomeness, and the Buddha has referred to it as even a noble search. In the Pali scripture language, given as Ariya Pariyesana. Now, what is this noble search about? And I'm quoting from the first volume of the Majjhima Nikaya, section 163. Here, someone being subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, namely Nibbana. Being oneself subject to aging, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, one seeks the unaging supreme security from bondage, namely Nibbana. And then, along the same line, being oneself subject to sickness, to death, to sorrow, and certainly to mental defilements, one understands the respective danger, and then seeks the undefiled supreme security from bondage, namely Nibbana. This, the Buddha says, is the noble search. Now, what I'm trying to get at is that if we realize that the work we're involved or engaged in here is not just some ordinary work, but it is actually a noble form of work, then this kind of reflection might then determine to some extent our attitude towards practice. So with this, certainly then we will realize, well, what we're doing here is not just hanging out, spending time, enjoying good food and good accommodation, but there's much more to it, and I might as well apply myself wholeheartedly to the practice. Now, we might certainly further reflect on the preciousness of this retreat, and Sapna on the preciousness of the preciousness of or the pricelessness of the Dhamma. So it takes a number of or it takes the coming together of a number of factors that allows for a retreat to unfold. It takes people with a lot of good intention, a good certain heart, a good volition to make something like this 1 month retreat possible. And to realize satna, this, and then to appreciate all the good effort, all the time, all the good intentions that have gone into organizing this retreat, and satna then with appreciation, with gratitude, to do one satna practice. Now, when it comes to the Dhamma, its value is beyond the value of ordinary worldly things. There, in the end, there is no price tag for the Dhamma. It is not available in any grocery store or wherever else. You cannot just pay a certain amount of money for it and then call the Dhamma yours. With cheap things, you can acquire those easily. Things that are a bit more expensive, you will have to work harder to then earn the necessary amount of money to then purchase certain of those certain things. When it comes to extremely precious certain items like gold and silver, jewelry and certain so on, houses and certain the like, they are very expensive and it takes a lot of work, a lot of effort to realize certain of those or to acquire those items. Now, the Dhamma is more precious than gold and silver and jewelry and houses and the like. And the Dhamma has been of tremendous value to many people, not only at the time of the Buddha, but also after his passing away, even now, and it will continue to be valid and valuable in the future. So here we have something that is extremely precious, that is more precious than any material worldly good, and thus if we want to gain this Dhamma, we do need to, needs to reflect in our attitude. Now, to help with this particular point, think of the owner of a vintage car. Now, some of you might not know what a vintage car is or what the so-called vintage area was. Cars that were manufactured between the beginning of 1919 and 1930 are known as automobiles of the vintage era. To give you some examples from this era, famous was the 1925 Flynn car, the 1926 Bentley Speed 6 Tourer, the Ranger 4, and the Model A20. Now, if you happen to be the owner of such a vintage car from the 1920s, then you will surely look after this car very carefully. You might even make arrangements. You will keep this vintage car in a special garage. You might even install a heating system there. And you might then, on a daily basis, go into the garage and shine up your vintage car. And if you see the slightest damage here or there, you will immediately get it repaired, and in doing so, make really sure that nothing gets broken. Now, on occasion, on a sunny and bright day, you might take your vintage car for an outing. You drive downtown Main Street, or you drive down Main Street in your hometown. In doing so, you will make sure not to bump into another person's car, and you will equally make sure that other people don't drive into your so precious car. And on occasion, as a proud owner of a vintage car, you might suddenly then also participate in a rally of vintage cars, but always very concerned about your precious car. Now, when you do your meditation practice, your mindfulness practice, think of yourselves as the proud owner of a precious vintage car, and maybe even more. Now, the practice that we're doing here concerns or is about the Dhamma. And just imagine, the Dhamma is far older than your vintage car from 1919 or from that period. And it is far more precious than a car from that period. So do shine up your meditation practice on a regular basis, and do care for your practice as much as possible. So the attitude that I would like to recommend in this context is to do one's own meditation practice with the greatest care and respect. The Venerable Sayadaw Pandita Bhimamsa, on many occasions when teaching mindfulness practice in Burma or abroad, stressed this aspect of care and respect. For many years I thought, my goodness, this is maybe a bit too much. But actually teaching, I do realize that there's a lot to this aspect. So it's not just the attitude that we bring to our meditation practice, but the value that we give the practice itself. The esteem that we have, or the lack of esteem for the practice. Now, if we consider that the mindfulness practice that we're doing here is something really noble, and that the Dhamma that is part, or that the practice is based in the Dhamma, is extremely precious, then we might consider the meditation practice itself as worth of greatest respect. And then it will be so much easier to practice with an attitude of care and respect. If that attitude is present in your own meditation, I can guarantee you that your meditation will unfold in no time. Now, on many occasions, the Buddha stresses purity. Purity or purification? Purification of what? Purification of our bodily conduct, purification of our verbal conduct, and purification of the mind. And so when we do this mindfulness practice, we want to keep this in the back of our mind and work towards ever greater purity in physical, verbal, and mental conduct. Now, as we engage in our mindfulness practice, this will then, and we're mindful from moment to moment, this will then also result quite naturally. When mindfulness is present in a continuous manner, wholesome mental states are likely to arise. Now, earlier on, quite a number of attitudes were mentioned that, as we've seen, are not all that helpful towards our own meditation practice. So having seen that, it becomes quite obvious that it is best to practice with an attitude that is colored by and based in non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, that is further based in in the absence of conceit, not being opinionated, that is based in the opposite of laziness, so in other words, a balanced effort, that's is not based in skeptical doubt, and an attitude that can be described as being calm, detached, practicing with an attitude, taking on an attitude of interest and curiosity. Now, allow me to elaborate on this interest or curiosity just for a little bit. If a teacher has to tell you, do this, do that, and etc., you might not be all that certain, interested to actually observe what is going on. But if you do your mindfulness practice and you really want to find out, okay, what is the rising and falling movement of the abdomen going to be like the next moment? And then the following moment, what is suddenly going to happen in terms of predominant feelings? Or I'll be very interested to find out what will happen next on a mental level. If you practice with this kind of a curiosity, then it's the curiosity itself that will pull you ahead. And then you yourself will want to find out what will happen next. And at that point, a teacher does no longer need to push. Now, we also want to practice with an attitude of a relaxed and alert mind, and with an allowing mind, allowing experiences to simply just unfold. Whether we like this or not, it doesn't really matter. Think of a researcher or a scientist. A researcher who has set up, put in a certain experiment, and then actually runs the experiment, will have to accept whatever the results of that experiment are. Whether the researcher likes those results or not doesn't matter. And so, as a retreatant in mindfulness, sudden meditation, we want to take the same kind of approach, namely the approach of a researcher, and in an objective manner, unbiased manner, observe whatever comes along. And even if the most unpleasant or very difficult experience comes up, well, we just treat it as another object of observation. We remember to label it. We observe it as best as we can in a non-reactive manner, not identifying with the experience, not getting carried away by it. And this will then make things so much easier. Now, also, it's helpful to practice with a gentle attitude of mind, not forcing the practice, not trying to do things in a rather harsh manner, trying to produce certain experiences. Also, we want to leave concepts aside and again be like that researcher and simply observe, carefully observe whatever is happening. To add one or two more aspects here, to surrender oneself to the practice, to practice with devotion, to give oneself wholeheartedly to the practice. Now, there's other aspects that might help a great deal. And among those are to slow down all of one's activities. This aspect of fitness slowing down is not necessarily favored in all traditions of Vipassana meditation. There's at least one tradition that clearly discourages this aspect of fitness slowing down. So it's worth then to look at what is involved in slowing down. What might be the reasons for slowing down one's activities? Now, first of all, if we come from an experiential point of view, then it certainly can be stated that retreatants who practice over an extended period of time, so several weeks, even several months, will naturally slow down their activities. It is a natural process. It's not something that's artificial. Now, when we actually slow down our activities, then we might find that slowing down supports the intensity of our practice, as well as coming into the present moment and being in the present moment. It further supports the development of mindfulness, of concentration, as and based on those the arising or development of intuitive wisdom. So the arising of wisdom could be stated as a clear-cut benefit of this slowing down of activities. Slowing down will allow us to go deeper, to investigate or probe more carefully and more deeply. Slowing down in our walking meditation, slowing down activities during, let's say, when taking a meal or on other occasions, will open up a microcosm of new experiences. Now, obviously, in our ordinary world, outside of an intensive retreat, it's important to do things quickly and efficiently. This, yes, but in going about things in this way, we miss out on so many details. We simply just do not notice those details. And slowing down very much helps to pick up things that usually escape our attention. As a result of slowing down, in the context of an intensive retreat, we might find that overall we make less mistakes. For instance, we drop less items, cutlery, or maybe a napkin. We slam doors less often than we would do under normal circumstances. So slowing down is a way of coming into closer contact with what is actually happening. Now, to give you an illustration for this, when you watch a movie that is played at such an ordinary speed, well, you see the whole story there. And then you might think, okay, that's all to it. But when that same movie gets played at slow, at much slower speed, then you will recognize very clearly that a movie consists of an X number of individual slides, one after another. So by slowing down that same movie, one realizes there's a different reality to it. So the same thing goes for our mindfulness sutta practice. Now, an aspect that sometimes does not receive much attention during mindfulness practice is the aspect of intensity, the intensity with which we practice. Different approaches are there. One could certainly say, well, intensive 1 month retreats are not for me. I'm going to be mindful for the remainder of my life. However, that mindfulness is going to be a bit more on the surface. That's would be a valid approach. Some people take this approach and certainly then think that this is the way to go. So when it comes to intensity of a practice, it could be that our practice, that we practice with low intensity, but it could also be that we practice with quite certain some intensity. Now, in The Mahasa tradition of Vipassana meditation, much emphasis is given to the intensity with which we practice. And the late Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw of Burma has expressed this by way of an illustration, namely by saying many centuries ago, maybe 1,000 years ago, before the invention of matches and gas lighters, in order to produce a fire, people had to energetically and unremittingly rub two sticks of wood together so as to attain the necessary intensity of heat, and that then would lead to a spark and then a fire. So the same thing applies to our meditation practice. It's important to keep up the intensity of practice as much as possible. Now, there are certain activities or certain ways of practice, certain behaviors that are helping to intensify our practice, and others that are not necessarily that useful. Now, during previous Satna Dhamma talks, the importance of mindfulness has been stated, and in particular the continuity of this mindfulness. In the end, it's not just a matter of continuity of mindfulness, but also a matter of continuity of our effort as well as our concentration, and that then leads to the arising of the intuitive wisdom. Now, the Buddha spoke of six qualities that would lead to the decline of a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni, or in general terms, of a practitioner. One is delight in work, the next is delight in talk, delight in sleep, delight in company, not guarding the sense doors, and then lack of moderation in eating. So, this is what Satna the Buddha did, or these are the points that he stressed in the context of maintaining a certain intensity of practice. This then applied to our modern day situation would mean that we keep unrelated activities aside, that we don't get involved in them, such as excessive reading, as well as extensive writing, and especially journal writing. Then, with the cell phones around, making of plenty of calls, or sending SMS messages, or simply talking to fellow retreatants, excessive socializing, and so on. If one were to engage in those activities, they would definitely decrease the intensity of one's practice. So therefore, it's best to keep those to an absolute minimum. Now, Marcia had mentioned already avoiding eye contact among retreatants, and one might add, let's say when you are in the dining hall having your meal, breakfast, or lunch, and you've put some food into the mouth, and suddenly you're chewing the food, then you might consider to close your eyes for a little while to then totally focus your attention on the process of chewing itself and the different flavors that suddenly go along with the morsel of food, the texture of it, the temperature of it, and certain other qualities. Now, on occasion among new retreatants, one finds that when the end of a session, a sitting session, approaches, or towards the end of a session, then such a newcomer would time and again open the eyes and check the time. Now, if one were to do this frequently, this would really disrupt one's sadhana practice. And so every time one opens one's eyes, some agitation will be created, some ripples will be created in the mind. So if you want to intensify your practice, then you might want to cut back on such kind of an habit. Now, especially at the beginning of a retreat, it's not necessarily always pleasant to have some intensity of practice going. Now, that's a natural occurrence. And if it's there, then simply be mindful of it, and over time, the mind does get used to the intensity of one's practice, and one becomes quite okay with it. To give you one more illustration, namely illustration for the intensity of practice. During later stages of mindfulness meditation, it happens quite naturally among retreatants that they are so absorbed in the observation of a predominant object, whatever that object might be, that they are barely aware of what is going around them, especially during the sitting meditation, even during the walking meditation. So one might be doing one's walking meditation and barely aware of other retreatants passing by, and at such a point, one might feel as if being in a bubble. And it's that kind of an intensity that will gradually develop over time. So it's not what I'm not trying to say to force these things, but to work towards a certain intensity of practice. Now, this pretty much brings us to the end of our Dhamma talk on attitudes do matter in mindfulness sadhana meditation, and allow me to close by wishing, equipped with a really wholesome attitude, applying yourselves wholeheartedly to the practice, practicing with greatest care and respect, may your meditation unfold smoothly, swiftly, easily, and may the peace of Nibbana be yours. And this is it for tonight.